We are starting today on, in a way, this is a continuation of what we talked about last week. Yeah, it did seem like yesterday. The title of today's talk is The Muslim Mind, Resisting Intellectualism and Critical Thought. Big words, indeed. The only problem is that we have not been able to live up to such a thing. And let me start with a quotation from Shakespeare, who says something that's very relevant to the state of the Muslim world today. There's nothing more confining than the prison we don't know we are in. Let me repeat it. There's nothing more confining than the prison we don't know we are in. I think we are in a big prison. And we'll explain through the course of this discussion what that prison is. But of course, the important thing is that we have to know what the prison is, where the walls are, how to fight it and break the walls and get out of it. Last week, I gave you a historical structural outline of why we have ended up where we are. Today's talk is going to be mostly reflective, and I would like to invite comments on that. And it's reflective in the sense that, yeah, you can describe the system all you want to, but how do we Muslims generally feel about where we are? I think that confining thought that Shakespeare is talking about is stagnation. And stagnation is not just economic or social stagnation, but the stagnation of the intellect in the Muslim world in general. The cause, you can refer to the recession. Again, this is an economic term, but when I'm talking about the recession, it's that downward trend that began sometimes in the 16th century, when Muslims had been kind of at the apex, at the zenith, at the top of the world civilization for so long, that they probably took it for granted that it was always going to be like that without them doing anything about it. And today's reality shows that that's not so, that you have to work for a cause to make it relevant to all times, or at least to the time in which you live. But it's unfortunate that when you look at that stagnation, yes, it started in the 16th century. It was a pre-colonial thing. But then it became colonial. During the entire age of colonialism, Muslims were pretty dormant. And then it continues to be so also in the post-colonial time. And so it persists and lingers. It has a hold on the Muslim society. And we are, in a sense, in a double bind. We know we are stuck in it. But oftentimes when we ask people why we Muslims are the way we are compared to the rest of the world, compared to other faith communities, compared to other religions, to other societies. And the answer you often get from people is, and I'm talking about the layman or the laywoman, the ordinary person in the Muslim world, is that they will tell you, we are this way because we have not lived up to the ideals of Islam. In other words, that we are not Muslim enough. And then if you pursue that question, that's, well, okay, If we are not the way we are supposed to be, then how are we supposed to be? And how do you present that? How do you idealize? How should we be? And oftentimes they come up with a ready-made answer. They will recommend that, well, the Muslim world is in such a terrible situation because Muslims don't pray, because they don't fast, because they don't give alms. And then you wonder, like, wait a minute, so we are this bad because we didn't follow certain rituals? And no matter how much you pursue that, you're not going to get anything different. They might add a few more examples of rites and rituals, of prayers and giving alms and all the things that we all know. And nobody asked the question that, wait a minute, is there really a connection, such a connection between the way we perform our prayers and where we stand? You can pray all you want to, but that's not going to make you an astrophysicist. You can fast all you want to the point of starvation if you want, but that is not going to help the Muslim economy. As a matter of fact, the food consumption in the Muslim world during the month of Ramadan increases by 23%. It defeats the very purpose for which even that ritual is there. But the idea is that people allude to things that are part of rites and rituals, and that's what how Islam is perceived. If we look at the whole history of the Muslim communities, the Muslim faith, and the Muslim civilization, you see that happened in a trend or in the context of values that are, if not totally different, for the most part, they're very different than that which people advocate today. That at the early period of Islamic thought, Muslims were a faith community. So obviously it was prophet-centered. It was Quran-centered. And at least in its external appearance, yes, rites and rituals centered. But the rites and rituals were secondary. What was more important for the early Muslims was how you behaved, the akhlaq, the ethics. And that's not a word you will find in the vocabulary of most people who suggest reforms today. Nobody's talking about rights, nobody's talking about a moral conduct of a person that would make you a good Muslim. Rather, they talk about prayers, which are something very personal. My idea of the reform would be that we have to switch from rites and rituals to ethics and morality. By switch, I don't mean you turn off your religiosity. I don't mean you stop praying. Yeah, you can pray all you want to and pray double and triple and even more. You can fast and give alms. All those things are good, but that is between you and your God. The reason we are where we are is because we have forgotten the second half of that, which is the relationship between you and your society, your fellow human beings, your community, your world community. This is what we have neglected. So yes, we do emphasize the rites and rituals, which are personal, but we display them in public. So we take the personal and make it public. And we take that public part, which is your moral conduct. We either make it personal or you make it irrelevant. I've heard of, I think there was a particular talk given somewhere, I think in Afghanistan, that amounted to the following, that you can bribe a government official so long as you pray. You can steal and rob and kill, and you can do all sorts of in human things, forbidden things, un-Quranic things. You can do all of that. So long as you pray, it's okay. In other words, the society has also accepted your outer appearance to be the criteria of your true worth, not necessarily the other way around, which, like I said before, if we make emphasis on how we behave, how responsible we feel towards our fellow human beings, how we help the needy, if this, which has to be public out of necessity, becomes our outer appearance, and the other, our prayer, which is a private thing, becomes our private appearance, then we should have no problem. But we, kind of like we buy and sell with the wrong currency. Say you're in Mexico, but you want to use dollars, and you come to the United States and you want to use pesos. It's not going to work. At least the pesos would not work in the United States. So the identity of a Muslim in the Muslim world and the criteria by which a Muslim is judged is not on that person's behavior toward the world community, but rather on that person's very private, very personal relationship with God Almighty. So I think this is a major problem. Sorry for the phone calls. They always happen at the wrong time. So let me look at it in a different way. Again, going back to that first question, why we Muslims are the way we are. And always the answer is externalizing the cause and the effect. I think for the Sunni Muslims, the problem is the absence of their ability and their right, or at least the perception that they do not have the right to think for themselves. At one point, the hierarchical power structure that faith communities such as the Catholic Church, for instance, had, did not exist in the Muslim world, at least in the Sunni realm of the Muslim world. There was not hierarchical structure. So this was its strength, because they were able to prevent the formation of a theocracy in the Muslim world. And that has now become its weakness, because there's no responsible authority. Some may refer to Al-Azhar, and other might refer to the Jamia in Saudi Arabia or some other country, but there is no hierarchical structure to which you refer to. And by reference, what I mean is that there is a perception that the doors, the gates to ijtihad are closed. Again, I'm talking only about the Sunni part of the Muslim world. And when you go to through the literature, you go through history and say, like, wait a minute, where, when, how? The doors to ijtihad are not closed. But the perception is there. So what is closed is our mindset. The minds are closed. And we are believing in that, yeah, the gate to ijtihad is closed. So we can't do anything about it. The only thing we can do about it is to go to the time when the gates were open. And when was that? 1,000 years ago. And so before I continue on that, let me go to the Shi'i side. The problem with the Shi'is is that, oh no, the door to ijtihad is not closed, it's open. But you have certain mujtahids who have the monopoly, sort of, the marja'i taqlid, that they have the right to explain for you how things are. Let's put it in a more general terms. And the problem with this is that well, compared to the Sunni thinking that the gate is closed, at least here the gate is open, so that is positive. But then that adds to the Shia clergy power structural hierarchy, which results in what? Results in the same thing that happened to the Europeans, that the Orthodox and the Catholic Europe created theocracy. So all of a sudden we have an Islamic theocracy through Shia thinking. Is that a solution or it's a problem? Well, the way I look at it as a problem is that that theocracy comes in the age of democracy. And so it creates a clash between what is democracy and what is theocracy. And most often people act on the basis of what the word connotes or which words are more familiar to you. So if you say an Islamic republic, that sounds very Islamic. But if you say democracy, it is perceived to be something Western, alien, foreign. So you'd rather go for something that is not alien, that is not foreign, that is yours, to which you can relate to. And so the end result is that theocracy then prevents free thought. And that is what the crux of the matter is that both the Sunnis and the Shis suffer from a different aspect, and that they both got to where they are, and they are cherishing values that are dated, that are not for our times. So these are, in a way, the signs of our stagnation, which appears in what form? In the form of moral corruption, political corruption, violation of human rights, resistance to democracy, resistance to civil order and civil laws and human laws. And in that sense, the thing that comes easily to mind is the women's rights, for example. That the women's rights are violated throughout the Muslim world, the so-called Muslim world. And that, I'm sure those of you who know the life of the Prophet, was the Prophet's very, very first campaign before he was even a prophet, defending and fighting for the women's rights. Yes, the live burial and those might have been the beginnings of it, but it wasn't limited to that. So today's Muslim world is then defined by all these forms of corruptions, which are part of that outer personality that we are supposed to express and present, and we don't. So then the question is that we have a problem with both the appearance, what appears and what appeals. The appearance I explained. We are more interested in looking Muslim than acting Muslim. And the appeal is the second part. The appeal is that when you ask Muslims for how to solve a problem or what sources do they have in their legal system, in their jurisprudential system, in their science and their technology and all that. And the Muslim will speak with a great pride of how things work. You ask them a question about the present, they run to the past. The glorious past, wonderful, but that's the past. I ask you a question about now. So it, in a way it is kind of, when you use that Hollywood terminology, back to the future. For the Muslims, that is back to the way back then. And the word future it's not even in the vocabulary there. And there, of course, we have to look at it that it's that this problem is persistent and continuous, is that people don't think in the present because they are stuck too much in the past. Why is that? Again, part of that, the Sunni thinking of the Gate of Ijtihad issue. And that's why when you ask them about a problem that might be relevant, obviously, to today's crisis among the Muslim world, take, for instance, how to fast, or, you know, how to make wudu, or some very trivial things, they are going to quote Imam Hanifa or Imam Hanbal for you, or Imam Jafar. And they're going to tell you, oh, well, this is what it says, that when you make wudu, you make sure that the water runs from elbow to the armrest. And the other says, no, 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 Imam Hanifa said it should run from the armrest to the elbow. And so there will be big fights about this. That is not even relevant today. You go to the shower and you take a shower and don't worry about which way the water runs. But how many of us are thinking that way? But then that we can go back to that first question. So why is the person going back to Imam Hanifa? And for those of our Shia brothers and sisters, I'm explaining Imam not in the Shia context. In the Sunni context, Imam doesn't have the linkage or the lineage or the authority of a Shia Imam. It's simply a scholar. So in that way, one, that a modern problem is answered, today's problem is answered with a solution of 1,000 years ago. That is the problem. So what happens to today's problem? Today's problem remains irrelevant then. If it's irrelevant, you can't find a solution for it, and the problem is going to persist. Others who might take a step a little further, like we go to the Quran, and how do we read? Yeah, we talked about the emphasis on khatam, or finishing the Quran, rather than understanding it. But there are many other issues that are, not that they are not important in the development of the theology of Islam, the kalam part of it. That is there. We have to know where we were, so we know where we have come from and where we are headed. But there are issues that are not relevant in the sense, for instance, the emphasis on Tawheed. Most of the world community believes in one God. The age of the tribal gods is gone. So Tawheed is not a critical issue in that sense. If it is, we might look at the significance of Tawheed, not in the sense that people worship more than one God, and most people don't, as I say, but perhaps in the context of the depersonification of God, or for that matter, the depersonification of the shaitan or the iblis, that we have given them an identity, we have given them a personality, and we treat them that way, and we expect them to treat us just like another person with a personality, a human person with a personality, who could get angry at us and become very vengeful, and they like this or they not. Not as God, as the totality of cosmic reality, that is a field of energy that is in everything. And if you give it personality, you could go even further. The way we perceive angels, for instance, that every drop of rain is brought down to earth by an angel. And so then you give it a personality and you imagine like, oh my God, how would these angels look like? Because at that time, the concept of a field of energy, such as gravity, for instance, was not recognized in the way it is understood today. So we could consider the field of the Earth's gravity as angelic in that sense, because God's law is the law of nature, and nature has its own rules. And these rules, as in the Quranic terms, we use the word ayah, the signs, both to a word in the scripture, in the Quran, but as well as to the reality outside of it. And that's why in the Quran, God refers to these ayahs almost as frequently. واللیل والضحا, concept of time, والتين والزيتون, a phenomenon in nature, trees, mountains, all these things are referred to because these are signs from which you learn. And the Quran is telling you, didn't we send water from heaven? And all the other examples that I'm sure you can quote better than I. But we have not depersonified God. And so if we need Tawheed, that's where we have to go. Not the concept of from many gods to one, because that has already happened. The concept of eschatology, for instance, and the belief in the hereafter. The Quran addresses it extensively, partly because many in the Jewish tradition did not believe in it. And now almost everyone does. So again, that may not be a relevant issue or a hot topic in that sense. Even words such as Ansar, for instance, you ask the average person, what is Ansar? They mean the Christians. Then when you ask them the Christians, they define a Christian that is not the Christian that the Quran is talking about. Today's Christianity is Hellenic Christianity, the one that started in Europe. The Christians of the time of the prophet were not the Hellenic Christians, but the Ebionites. This was a different group of Christians. And the family of Khadija and many in Mecca were Ebionite Christians, but not Hellenic Christians, not necessarily Trinitarian Christians. Or you could also ask a question like, what does this Quran consist of? I couldn't find enough coordination the way it's written. 1 minute talks about one issue, and then the next one or two sentences, the whole topic changes. And you say, oh, well, the Quran is mostly muhakamat and mutashabihat. That is the literal and the metaphorical. These criteria were developed 1300 years ago. But nobody's talking about the Quran talking in references, the Quran talking in analogies, the Quran talking about in the context of and time and space that was relevant at their time. There are many ayahs in the Quran that are simply used as reference point, not that they are necessarily historical facts. But because we were given only the criteria of the muhakamat and mutashabihat, then we end up addressing the rest of the Quran mostly as in a very literal sense. And this literalism is it's a major problem. And to tie it back to the argument I stated earlier was that if you are to answer today's problem with today's solution, then you have to accept today's scholarship. But the tendency in the Muslim world is that today's scholarship is irrelevant. We have great scholars like Dr. Suroosh, like Allama Iqbal, like Abul Fadl. There are many, many more. The reason these scholars, who are probably in some ways more qualified than the ones of 1,000, 1,200 years ago, is because the stage is full. And because on the stage, there are four or five chairs, and they are taken by Imam Jafar, Abu Hanifa, and Hanbala, Imam Malik, and Imam Shafi, and they're not coming down. So if the stage is full, these other people of our time who have the scholarship, who have the knowledge, who have the understanding, much better, because they are relevant to our time and space. They will never get there to the stage because the stage is full. And so why is the stage full? Because that's the only way we can think. We can only think in the past. And that's how we have kind of, what's the correct term? We have fossilized our thinking. we are so much stuck into the past that the present is irrelevant. And if the present is irrelevant, we shouldn't expect to live to the standards of the present, of the rest of us who live in the present. So we are excessively preoccupied in the past, and we are excessively preoccupied with rites and rituals. And so in that case, it's a mind that's stuck in the past. And I'm thinking that what is necessary for us to unstuck our mind. Why do we need to do that? We need to do it because we have to look at all the glory of the past, and we realize how the Muslims, who were a religious-centered community, learned how to be a reason-centered community. And when they became a reason-centered community, most of the people around the world who were, who shared that link, not necessarily the faith, but they shared the reasonability of the reason. In other words, the reason-centered thinking. They came to the fold and they joined and they helped the Muslims build a whole civilization. The Greeks were a reason-centered society. Some Indians were, some Persians were, some Central Asians were, some Egyptians were. So the Islamic civilization that we take so much pride in was not built because people are praying a lot. They might have been praying a lot, but that was their business. That has no role in our life. It doesn't matter how many times a particular scholar prayed. What mattered was that what did that scholar brought to the table of this universal human civilization? And so how do we get to the reason? Some might think it's blasphemous. It's not blasphemous because the first manifestation of God was in the form of reason. God became the aql kull, the total intellect. So through that first manifestation of God as reason, as intellect, as aql, from that aql kull that we have become the aql juz, that we are a partial reasoning, or rather limited, or you can say relative, since we are not absolute. We define our rational being in relativity, another version of the relativity that Einstein talked about. And so in this relativity, we can operate in the following way. Rely and depend on reason. Understand what reason tells you. But reason tells you one more thing. Always doubt. Because if you don't doubt, you will consider the issue solved and you will not be able to go any further. So the reasonable thing for reason-centered thinking is to oscillate between reason, to oscillate between doubt uncertainty, go back and forth. Believe in something once you understood it fully, but doubt it, because then you can ask yourself, this is how I understand it now. But since I live in the relativity, not in the absolute, which is God's domain, then I'm supposed to leave that absolute, go back to the relativity, ask my doubt to become my teacher, to become my God, guide, and lead me towards a better understanding of what I already understand. So doubt should become your teacher, and reason should become your entity. And it's through reason that you can work. And so here we can go back to what I said earlier, that our faith-centered thinking gave us a religion. But it was our thought-centered thinking that helped us create the world's first universal civilization. If you take pride in it, then act in it the way they did. That should be your model. And this doesn't mean that faith is irrelevant. I'm not suggesting that, not at all. Keep your faith to yourself, because that's not affecting anyone. That's between you and God. That's the vertical axis. You need the horizontal one, where you connect with the rest of humanity, and that you can do through reason. And not to mention the fact that the Quran refers to this characteristic of us, reason. In this, there are signs we have sent to those who think. What is the Quran telling you? This is the greater worship. We have sent you sign to think, so figure it out. Otherwise, you're in ghafla, you're dormant, you're sleeping. Wake up. And so if we go through that, the clash that sometimes occurs is as follows. That a faith-based person, especially in a dormant society like most of the Muslim world today, is that if someone thinks differently, you consider that a blasphemy. That's why we don't allow for the freedom of thought. That's why we don't allow for the freedom of religion. That's why they continue chopping people's head. Why? Because this person believes in a different God, or in God in a different way. All the killings that are happening in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Syria, in Yemen, why are they happening? Because a person's humanness, humanity, is not important. What matters to them is how that person prays. And so if we go on the basis of that, and then we try to kill everyone who thinks differently than us, at one point, if we succeed, if we have the time and the length of lifespan, the only person that will be left at the end will be you, because you would have killed everyone who thinks different. Why? Because by nature, we are supposed to be thinking different. That's why there is a head on everyone's shoulder, not on the shoulder of some bodies and not of others. Look at it in the other way. Quran is defining God in the chapter of light as God is the light of the universe. Allahu nuru samawati wal ard. That includes everything. That is the universe. A beautiful ayah, but what does it mean? If you are seeking God, you ought to be seeking light. What is the nature of light? Light reveals that which could not be seen without it. So you go to a dark room, you don't see a thing until the light comes. Then you see thing when the light is there. Now, use the light of God in a metaphoric sense is to take your torch and your candle, your flashlight, go around wherever there is darkness, shed the light on it, and try to see the reality as is. Unfortunately, it wasn't the Muslim world who used that Allahu Nuru Samawati wal Ard concept to create the movement of enlightenment. That was developed by the Europeans. The age of enlightenment came in Europe instead of in the Muslim world. But then you say, who is enlightened? What does that mean? An enlightened person is a person who's open-minded. When I say open-minded, obviously in the literal sense, it is the opposite of a closed-minded person. Who is a closed-minded person? A closed-minded person is one who reaches a certain reality and rests on it and accepts that an eternal truth, forgetting that person, himself, herself, is in a state of relativity. We constantly learn more. So the things that you could see through a certain light yesterday should not be the same as today, unless you have turned off the light. And for most of the Muslims, yes, we use the torchlight of 1,000 years ago, and we try to find the reality or define the reality of today. So what should be relevant would be that same Quranic command, which has repeatedly told us to do what? Reason and think. So we have to go through reason and knowledge, and we have to have the ability to do deep thinking. Now, what is deep thinking? The Arabic term, if I understand it enough, and my Arabic is limited, like I'm limited in every other way, is one is fikr, which is thinking. That is spontaneity. That is the motorized thinking. That is the thinking you think when you're not even thinking. For instance, if you're going home from the supermarket, you're not really thinking and waiting in every intersection to say, okay, here I make a left turn, there I make a right turn. No. That thinking happens spontaneously. That's one thing. One is tafakkur, which is deep thinking. And here you're intentionally delving into the heart of a particular crisis or a problem, and you try to find solutions. So one who is able to do a deep thinking, and then that is a person with a deeper awareness, approaching things from a critical perspective to present it to the society, present the society with new ideas for the purpose of social improvement. So a deep thinker is an inventor, a creator, someone who comes up with a great new ideas that help humanity. And once you learn that, you might think, good, you know, I had my new flashlight. I went to this dark corner and I found the truth. And that's it. I did my job. Not so. We go back to the Quran. What was the first revelation? Iqra, meaning what? Read, or announce, or declare, or speak. Just because you found the truth, your job doesn't end there. You owe it to the society. You owe it to the rest of the world to share that truth with them, so that if it has benefited you personally, it can also benefit the rest of the humanity in that way too. So take the concept of the Iqra and have the guts to say it. You have discovered the truth. Don't be afraid of saying it. The prevalence of an air of ignorance in the Muslim world is such that the clergy that we didn't used to have, but we have plenty of them, in the terms of the ordinary person who leads the prayer in the mosque, to the mullahs and different other titles they give, they hold a sway over the society, and they are using religious rhetoric as a great weapon, because they benefit from the ignorance of the society, because you can manipulate ignorance much better than knowledge. And therefore, they are using the weapon of takfir, the weapon of blasphemy, that anytime you say anything different than what their limited mind can fathom, they are simply going to declare you, or to use a Western term, excommunication, that this person is kafir or kafir. Don't listen to him or her. So you become automatically stigmatized. And so this is a great challenge that has to be met head on. So use your reason, the first one I told you. Use the light, and these are all names of God. And use the Iqra, those are the words of God. And have the guts to speak out. Now remember, the prophet had the guts to say it to his wife Khadija, or to Waraqa bin Nawfal and to Ali and to Abu Bakr, to a few. But it was a great challenge. He couldn't share that with the rest of the world until the next revelation that came, Ya Ayyuhal Muzammil, which was a very straightforward command. Get up and tell them. So you want to follow a sunnah? That is the sunnah. Consider yourself as part of that, Ya Ayyuhal Muzammil, clad in the dark sheet which you have created around yourself. Throw it out. Create the light. Use your reason, use your knowledge, and go with it and share it with the world. So in this case, for you to be an enlightened Muslim, an open-minded Muslim, you have to have the ability to crack the status quo of the establishmentarian thought. If you think the Muslim world is so bad and you're keeping quiet about it, then it's not bad. Because through your inaction, you have accepted it. And you don't accept things unless they are good. So if you don't accept it because it's bad, then you better speak against it. And what is cracking the status quo? That is to have the ability to think, but to think free. Think free of constraints, including thinking free from religious constraints. Again, this doesn't mean you leave religion. Your faith is your business. That's fine there. But when you are thinking, you have to be thinking as free and as unconstrained as you can. And that was one of the reasons I quoted Shakespeare for you, is that there is nothing more confining than the prison we don't know we are in. And that's where we are. We are in that prison and we don't realize it. And we don't, you know, if you know you're in a prison, you know where the wall or the door is to break out or to do something about it. But we are in the, we have imprisoned our mind. And therefore, even if we want to open and free ourselves, we don't see where the gate is, where the door is. We are in a cage, but we don't know how to break it because we don't see it. And so, yes, free of religion thought, allow yourself to doubt, doubt even the existence of God if you want to know God. If you don't doubt it, that is the God of ghafla, your knowledge from a time of dormancy. And that is not allowed. And going back to the repeated ayahs of the Quran, it says that these are signs for those who think. So therefore, thinking has to be your most important worship. So, and talking about the clergy that has taken over the Muslim world, and as I told you, that they have sway over the thinking of the majority, which in a way matters, is that that because faith is so close to their heart, it can be manipulated easily. So that's the pitfall of having a faith, but in a state of closed-mindedness. And the reason that the West has called for a separation of state of church now, after nearly 1,000 years, when the Muslims called for the separation of state and church at the time of Khalifa al-Mansur, of the Abbasid Khalifa al-Mansur and Imam Hanifa, when Imam Hanifa told him, look, you mind your politics, that's your business, we will take care of the scholarship ourselves. So Islam was first to come and call for the separation of state and church. And so we have to play on that, is that do not allow politicians, governments, community leaders, tribal leaders, or people of whatever walk who are manipulating your faith because it's so close to your heart, and they can brainwash you through nationalism, through all kinds of political ideologies, all that. when it comes time for telling the truth, tell the truth regardless. Nothing should constrain you. Now, have the ability to speak from outside of the faith. Now, don't always be defensive. That's what the Christians say. That's what the Jews say. Listen to them. Maybe they're saying something that is true. And so, therefore, you could question, like, maybe you have the best religion, but maybe you're not following it the right way. And that's possible, too. So the job of a thinker is to be responsible for an awakening of the society for a change. If you don't change, you will be stagnant. The society will be dormant, like the way the Muslim world is today. And we have to break loose from that, is that you have to become a free thinker, and your job is to awaken the society. And I give you the steps, okay? The steps were use reason, use light, and use your gut feeling to have the ability to speak out. Why is this necessary? Because society is transitional. Society changes. And like I explained earlier, probably alluded to it lightly, that we live in a kind of a cross, the Christian cross. Don't accuse me of blasphemy. Our cross is as follows, that the vertical line that goes up and down is the human relationship with God, and the horizontal one is the one that is the human relationship with the other humans. We have a responsibility to both. And as I explained also earlier, that sometimes we mix the two, but let me not go there. So when you're talking about this horizontal line, your responsibility to the society, you talk to your society, to your community as your community, not the community in Medina in the time of the Prophet. That was a problem in Medina. That was a problem for the Prophet. And the Prophet resolved it the best he could in his time and his place. And that was his thing. We take him as a role model to emulate, to follow his action and learn from it. We are not necessarily there to follow him step by step exactly the way he did it, because our society has changed. So accepting the transitory state and nature of the society, we have to be ready to go for a change, accept change, and therefore think in an awakening for a positive change in society. If we don't change for the positive, we will be stuck in the dark, as most of us, unfortunately, are in the Muslim world. Let me stop here, and I think you might have some questions. I made a promise last week that I said that I will copy the questions from the chat box and consider them, but I wasn't able to. I didn't do something right, and so I didn't copy the questions. So if you still have those questions, I will be glad to entertain those. But let me also share with you, if I can share the screen. There are a few pictures that I want to share with you, and I want you to look at them and see how differently we can look at those images and what we see or take from them. Let me see if I can share the screen. Where is share the screen? Here we go. Okay, here is one image, and I'm going to play just a little bit of it. How old do you think this child is? Probably 3 or 4, the most. Look at this next picture. Look at the way they are dressed. Let me explain why I showed you the first one. Here, the emphasis is on rote memorization. The common reaction is that, mashallah, it's beautiful. I understand it's beautiful. You're looking at it from an adult perspective who has a religious understanding of a certain kind, and you're thinking this is wonderful for you, which is, yeah, I mean, his recitation is not only accurate, but it's beautiful too. But what does it do to a child of that age, that child's preoccupation? Rote memorization or critical thinking? I would say it's mostly rote memorization. Critical thinking, it's not there. Naturally, yes, but not necessarily in this activity. Here is another picture. What do you see? It's a grown-up parent who establishes a standard for religiosity and imposes it on little children like this. Yes, children should pray. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's more important that they pray out of conviction, not because their father told them. Here is another picture, which you probably don't want to see. Please, that frame here. This is the state of the Muslim children. And the cause is one so-called Islamic state imposing its political will on another state because some people there happen to be believing or worshiping a little bit different. This is probably from Yemen. And who pays the price? The Ummah. Here is Islamic education for you. Watch carefully. I'm sorry, this is kind of... I'm sorry, this becomes even harsher. The primary concern here is not education. It is that the adult has no background in teaching methodology, no background in psychology. And his anger and frustrations and complexes for which a person has become a subject. And so through the mind of this adult that we see here, which I don't think is much of an adult, okay, this child has become a victim. And what are we using? We are using religious manipulation, because his parents would be told that your child has to become a good Muslim, has to learn Quran. This is not learning Quran. Here is another picture. Let me play this one. And it's not in English, but I'll translate. Yeah, this person, it's a suicide bomber. Look at all the grenades and all the explosives that are all around him. And he has a gun in his hand. I'm sure that they somehow have disabled this. But this man is ready to go and kill and be killed. And he is asked, why are you doing this? And he says, oh, I'm doing it only for the sake of Allah. You heard that word in the beginning. And it's such a complete brainwashing that happens at a very early age in over thousands of madrasas in Pakistan, who are told that your only purpose in life is to die and kill the kafirs, kill the unbelievers. And those who sent him as a walking, ticking, literally walking, ticking bomb, had convinced them that's his job. And this interview is like about 2-3 minutes long, in which he is asked, he says, don't you worry about your parents. He says, oh, the only one thing I want my parents to know is that they should not cry after me, because I will be in heaven and I will be with 72 houris and the rest of it, I'm sure you know. Here is another picture. This comes from Afghanistan, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a desert. And it's a hot summer day. And this woman is wrapped over and over and over. Why? Because we don't want a non-mahram to look at her. I think this issue came up in the question period last week. Where is the non-mahram? And if there is one, whose responsibility it is? And so in Afghanistan, I think in most of the countryside, which is probably at least 70-75% of the country, women just can't not leave without being wrapped in this burqa. And again, this is considered what? Part of our religious behavior. And most Afghans have no idea that this was fashionable among the nuns in the Orthodox Byzantium. This was a Christian custom. And when the Muslim Turks came and took over Constantinople and found out that the royalty in the palace, because the Byzantium was both this head of the political state as well as the religious state, and therefore they were all clergies ruling the empire. And for them, this is the way a nun, an Orthodox nun would dress. And so the Ottoman Turks said, well, that probably is the fashion of their royalty, since we hold the power now. Let's see, our women should dress the same way, because now we are the kings, we are the rulers. And they copied it and it went all the way like a prairie fire throughout Central Asia and became fashionable. And in many countries it has died out, but not in Afghanistan. So this is the state of the Muslim world, and I will stop that. That we have to wake up, and by wake up, I don't know how big the W should be, but we really have to wake up. So let me see if we have any questions or if we have time for questions.
We have 5 more minutes, Dr. Stanazai.
Okay, 5 minutes. Well, I have an answer. Let's see if I first have the answer. The question is asked about the Sunni closure of the ijtihad. It's just that Abbasids were insecure at a certain time. And they excluded the Shias because, of course, they had laid a claim to the legitimacy of power. So the Jafari school was out. But from the others, the Khalifa declared that we will accept the school of thought of Hanifa, Malik, and Shafi, and Hanbal. And that's it. Nothing else was said. It wasn't said that others are not allowed to. But they said they will accept it during that time at these schools. And that became like a God-sent word. And we are not deviating from it. Let's see, others, the recording video. The video will be recorded if you still have the patience to watch it. Let's see, once we have a website. Okay, again, these are all technicals. Where are your recorded videos? The ones that I post, I always give my last name as part of the title. So everything starts with Stanizai hyphen whatever else the title is. It's not because I love my name so much, but because it's easy for easy. It's good for easy reference. That once you go to YouTube, if you type my name, the whole 200-300 videos will all pop up there. I think we had more questions last week. Like I told you, I don't have them with me. So if your question from last week remains unanswered, you can ask it now. And the sites, Or again, stanezai.com and stanezai.org. If you like the organic one, go to the .org one. That's in English. The .com is in Pashto and Dari in Farsi, Persian. Okay, will I post this one? Yeah, as soon as I get the link, I will probably, because now I don't have access to the raw footage to edit it. So I'll probably post it exactly the way it is and the way it will get to me. So whatever title is given to it, it will be posted, certainly on the Facebook, and then I'll put it on the websites as well. Okay, I think most of these questions are on the technical side. So I think we probably explored the issue. I hope I have not offended anyone. Let me just, in conclusion, say one more time. It's wonderful to be a person of God, to be with God, to worship God in any way you want to. I'm not speaking against that. I'm speaking against religious mindedness, not religion. I'm not speaking against Islam or against any religion for that matter, but it's the religious mindedness, which in a way people close their mind once they are certain that they have got it. And I never think of myself ever having gotten it. And I'm sure that I'll be laughing at myself tomorrow, if not sooner, when I listen to all the nonsense I've talked about today, because we have to grow continuously with time. And so the thrust of my talk is that do not allow the disenfranchisement of thought, of free thought. Think, and think critically. Be a reason-centered person. It is the command of the Quran. Use the light of God, not as a symbolic object of worship, but God as a field of energy that enlightens you and energizes you. And through that light and energy, you can find your way better. Make sure once you get to a certain truth, use the concept of Iqra, share it, be gutsy, take the risk. If you find the truth, you owe it to others who may have not reached it to share with them. So with that, I bid you farewell and I thank you for your patience. And I hope you haven't forgotten things that you already knew. My job always is to confuse people. And the reason is that through confusion, you keep thinking, you don't fall asleep. So if you're confused, I've succeeded, and thank you and have a nice day.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stanezai. We are not confused. We believe to the just the intellectual speech and to activate our brain. And we honor that to have you as a speaker. I have been speaking in the center. I was reviewing the paper yesterday since 2008. So since 2008, we have been listening to this intellectual speeches. And we adore you and we adore your personality. We appreciate that you keep coming to talk to us. And as I always believe, Islam is great, Muslims are not. Hopefully we can do better and better and better in the future. Thanks so much, everybody. Assalamu alaikum, we'll see you next week.
Thank you, not that I necessarily agree with all your compliments, but thank you out of courtesy and have a nice day.
Thank you.